Morning.
Morning.
Go ahead and be seated. All right, next on calendar, we have got case number 51878, Employers Insurance versus Employco. Something that I wanted to do earlier and I neglected, I was going to file a written disclosure and I didn't get it in. My cousin is counsel for ICON in some capacity. I don't know what it is. Of course, I've never had any discussion with her about this case or any other case that she has, but I needed to make that disclosure for the record.
And
doesn't have any bearing on my ability to hear the case.
I, too, have a disclosure. When I was in private practice, at one point I represented ICON, and at another point, one of my partners sued ICON. My representation was a one-time sort of one-off representation of an appeal for an arbitration award. It ended in 2001. And then the suit against ICON, I don't know much about. I ran a conflict search to determine what it was, and it appears to have ended by 2003, whatever that was. But the two matters were not obviously coextensive. They were separate points in time, but I should have made those disclosures as well. Neither had anything to do with this, and they don't affect my judgment of the case at all. In fact, I had forgotten until I looked at it.
And with that being said, if there are any objections at this point, if you could please make them for the record.
No objection.
Okay, then we'll go ahead and proceed. Mr. Dabowski, are you ready?
And please, the court, I would reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Please, the court, Your Honor, my name is Peter Dabowski. I'm attorney for Employers Insurance Company, Nevada. The issue before the court today is whether my client filed this underlying action within the statute of limitations, which is 6 years, when it was filed within 6 years of a credit that was given. That credit was given as a result of an audit, and that audit was conducted within the 6 years as well, and that audit could not have been conducted any time earlier than that 6 years, because that was the first time that the insured, the defendant in this case, actually furnished payroll records in order to calculate the premium due in accordance with the policy.
That causes a question for me. Going back to the very first invoice that you had sent, indicating there was a final audit, and what was that, in January, the very first invoice?
There was an invoice in January 2001. That was not an actual audit invoice. I'm aware that it does say audit on there.
But that's what they said. Had they paid that at that point, then what?
If they paid it, that certainly would have closed the case, but they probably would have.
So there wouldn't have been any subsequent invoices sent or any necessity to conduct any further audit?
Probably not, but they still have to close the case out. And in a lot of these cases, the insured is owed a refund. So although in the rare case that they actually went ahead and paid it, conceivably that could have closed the case out. But in fact, in these cases, you can see there's actually a credit that's given on for $258 in November 2002. That was a credit on a prior policy. So these policies are constantly in a state where even a prior policy, if somebody pays, somehow an audit will come up, and they'll have to review it again. It could have been they're entitled to a refund, and it would have reopened it again. So there was no audit, and in a rare circumstance where they did pay, may not have closed it out either.
Going back to that original invoice, is there a course of conduct that determines when performance is due? Is there anything? There wasn't anything stated on the invoice as to when it's due and payable, but
the audit, the invoice which you're referring to is the January 2001 invoice, was really just sent out of desperation, because the insured has an obligation under the policy and under statute to cooperate with the auditor and furnish the payroll records so that an actual audit can be done and an invoice sent for the payroll that's due. They never did that. And when the policy terminated in November 2000, they tried to get the defendant to cooperate. They wouldn't cooperate. Therefore, in January, knowing that it's, again, in the policy that premiums have to be determined at some point, they said, well, let's just estimate that it's $34,875 and just get an invoice out so we can do something with this policy, because we have to somehow address the fact that the policy says that insurance premiums will become due after the policy period ends. So really it was sent out of desperation because they could not get cooperation from the defendant.
The invoice says remit too, so on its face it looks as though it were a billing. Could you address that?
Well, really, again, it was out of desperation. They had to come up with some way of trying either to get the defendant to comply with their legal obligation under the policy and by statute to say, hey, listen, we need to audit. So they just basically, again, out of desperation, said, well, let's just send them something and let's just estimate what we think we should be paid.
When does the contract, we don't have the policy in the record, when does the policy say performance is due, reciprocal performance, payment of the amount invoiced? When is that due under the terms of the contract at issue here?
That would be after the policy terminates, within 3 years after the policy terminates, an audit is done, and that audit is done to calculate the final actual premiums due.
And so your position is there's no performance due until that point, so there was no breach and no reason to sue earlier?
That's correct. You cannot sue for the balance due until you do an audit and see if there's a balance due. Again, the policy also states that that after the audit, a refund could be due, and if a refund is due, they do receive the refund as well. The statute of limitations is Your Honors are aware, is 6 years. And the governing statute is NRS 11.190 and 11.200. 11.200 is the part of the statutory scheme which governs this case, because that is the only way that you can understand 11.190 as the statute of limitations. Statute of limitation, that statute states that the time in NRS 11.190 shall be deemed to date from the last transaction or the last item charged or last credit given. The last transaction was an audit. That was in December 2001. That resulted in a credit. That credit was also in December 2001. And the actual invoice, the real invoice, was January 2002. All of those events took place within 6 years. And again, they could not have taken place any earlier, because you can't calculate the premium without the defendant's cooperation in furnishing the payroll data in order to go through, do the audit, and do the final premium.
What do you do with the Havas versus Long decision on a gratuitously issued credit can't renew the statute of limitations?
Well, this is not gratuitous, because the transaction referring to was a result of the audit. Now, let me point out that there was actually another credit in November 2002. If I wanted to take the position that it was gratuitous, I could certainly say that the credit that was given for $258 in November 2002 was the last credit given. And I'm not taking that position. I'm taking the position that the credit given as a result of the actual audit in December 2001 is not a gratuitous credit, because that was the credit that was given as a result of complying with the policy, going through all the payroll data and saying, okay, the amount due is the $34,000 figure.
Where do we get these facts that you're arguing that would support your claim when the statute of limitations commences to run? What we have is a complaint and then a motion for judgment on the pleadings or summary judgment, to which is attached the 2001 audit that or invoice that says remit to. And then we have an opposition with some papers attached to it, but we don't have the contract, and it isn't clear to me what the history is of what was before the court. I appreciate your arguments, and it...
Well, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. What I'm looking for is you're arguing facts with respect to what occurred. Where do you get those facts?
Well, the facts, I believe, are in the record, because the opposition did attach the actual invoice from December 2001.
But there's no affidavit or other sponsorship for that, right?
I would have to look and see if there was an affidavit. Again, because it was disposed on a motion for judgment on the pleadings, we did not have the opportunity we could have to present, to have a full record of evidence that would normally be in such a case. But in fact, again, the dates are, and I don't believe the dates are disputed, that it was, and I believe in the record, there's also the November 2001 letter that contained the payroll data, and that was the first and only time that defendants actually complied with the statute and with the contract, being the insurance policy, to furnish that payroll data so that an audit can be done. Again, the operative dates, as your owners are aware, policy terminated 2000. My client could not get compliance from the defendant, not until November 2001. And again, that is already within the 6 years this action was filed. The audit was not conducted until December 2001. And that was the only audit, because there could have been no analysis of payroll data until they had the payroll data, and they did not have it until November 2001. So the audit was December 2001. It resulted in a credit. That credit was December 2001. It was reflected in the invoice, which is January 2002. The January 2002 is the actual invoice, and that is the invoice that is the basis of this lawsuit. So again, we have to look to the last credit given. That last credit given was the actual invoice, the actual audit. It was not gratuitous. It was a result of the actual full complete analysis of the payroll records, which is crucial. And the insurance policy itself states that the final premiums are based upon analysis of an audit of all the payroll records. And the policy also states they have to comply with the request to get those audit records. Although the case...
So when would you say your client had the right to demand under the contract payment of the premium?
In this particular case, it would not have been any time before they did the audit. And again, the actual payroll data was November 2001, which, by the way, again, was still within 6 years this action was filed. And then the audit was done December 2001, and not until the audit was completed could this action be brought. And the policy does state, and by the way, I'll point out that it's a standard workers' compensation insurance policy, and in a standard workers' compensation insurance policy, it says the audit can be done within 3 years after the termination of the policy period. So it was within the scheme prescribed by the insurance policy itself. It was within the 3 years.
Well, and I guess EmployCo is arguing that you had actually done an audit and sent the original invoice, and that there was no request for payroll data.
Well, that certainly is disputed, because my client was trying to get the payroll data. Matter of fact, they tried all throughout 2001. The defendant employee didn't just turn over the data out of the kindness of their heart. They did so because of my client pressing them to say, you have an obligation to turn this over so we can calculate the premium if you're going to tell us that the premium that we've estimated is not correct. But there was no audit until December 2001. And I'll just point out that in every one of the jurisdictions, now again, the case is governed by 11.200 on how you calculate the statute of limitations. That's what governs the case. We have a lot of case law from other jurisdictions. All of the case law supports our position, because in every one of those cases, it says the statute of limitations does not accrue until after the audit is conducted. An audit must require an actual audit of going through payroll data. You can't audit without documents to audit. So even looking at the persuasive authority from every jurisdiction with every case that's cited here, this case was filed within 6 years, statute of limitations of 6 years, from the date of the audit, which was December 2001.
So how'd you come up with the original invoice amount that was so fairly close to what apparently the audit amount would have been, with the exception of a couple credits?
Well, respectfully, my client is good at what they do. So when they had to estimate, they were pretty close. And again, it's what they do.
What was the reason for putting final audit on the invoice that was the basis for the motion for summary judgment or judgment on the pleadings?
Again, it was really an act of an unconventional circumstance where you have an insurer that is not assisting and not cooperating and not complying with the statutory duties to assist the auditor and turn over records and the contractual duty under the policy. They put something together, and I guess, unfortunately, the words final audit appeared on there, but they could have put on there act of Congress. It wouldn't have made it any more of an act of Congress if they called it an act of Congress. It was not an audit. And there's no misapprehension that it was an audit, because the defendant knows, well, how could you audit our payroll records? We didn't give them to you. So the fact they called it a final audit, or whatever they did call it or chose not to call it, is really fortuitous. What is correct is that the final invoice that does say final audit, and that is actually the final audit invoice, was January 2002.
Counsel, I'm having a little bit of a problem. I don't have the complaint with me today, but I made a little note that it seemed that the complaint and the answer didn't specify what the date of the invoice was. And so how do we arrive at this January 19th date in this motion for judgment on the pleadings when it's not mentioned in the invoice?
I'm not sure, with regard to your question as to the answer, I'm not sure what is in the answer. I don't even believe an answer. I guess an answer was filed with this motion for judgment on the pleadings, but all the evidence was at the time of the motion for judgment on the pleadings, and at that time, we did produce the invoice.
But the invoice was 2002, not a 2001.
Right.
That's my question, because the court seems to be going on a 2001 date, and I'm saying where they get that piece of information.
Must have been something that, again, it was an errant. The invoice that is an issue in the case is the January 2002 invoice, and that's the one we reproduced. The January 2001 invoice is not a correct invoice. It was an errant invoice. It was issued out of desperation to get something, to get the client to comply. But what's at issue in the case is the January 2002 invoice.
And as I indicated, I don't think that was part of your complaint. And did that come within the motion for judgment on the pleadings?
I believe that's the time it was presented. Because, again, we sued on the obligation under the policy, and that obligation was alleged in the complaint.
All right, we chewed up quite a bit of your rebuttal time with questions. I'm going to give you an additional 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Shall I step down? Or?
Yep.
Yes, thank you.
And, counsel, if you could clarify that little question I just asked in terms of how we get to this January 19, 2001 date and the circumstances we have before the court on this judgment on the pleadings.
Sure. In just quickly reviewing the complaint, I don't believe that there is a specific date identified within either the complaint or the answer. I can't believe it would be identified in the answer. We did, however, I believe, attach it as part of our motion for judgment on the pleadings, and obviously that's an issue as to whether it was adjudicated as motion for judgment on the pleadings or as motion for summary judgment. I think the result remains the same ultimately. The document that was sent on January 19th of 2001.
Well, if it's a summary judgment, wouldn't that billing have to have some type of affidavit attached to it?
I don't believe it does, because I don't think it's disputed that it's an authentic document. The parties haven't disputed that in any way, shape, or form. I think it is what it is. It's part of the record.
Well, there seems to be a dispute as to whether that's a final document. No.
Well, I understand, Your Honor.
Which, if we're summary judgment, that would kind of get us into a disputed fact.
Well, material
fact, if we're going to exercise this on a summary judgment basis.
I don't think, I'm sorry.
Statute of limits basis, rather.
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I mean, on the face of the document, it is an invoice. It does identify specifically a final audit, and it can only be construed as a request for payment. And the important point with regard to this particular invoice is that it evidences the ability of Econ to demand payment, that it has knowledge of its claims, and as such, statute of limitations begins to run at that point in time. Now, we do have in here a second document in the record, and I believe that is the... November 12, 2002 reconciliation letter. And if you look at the second page of that document, there's a graph, and it does identify on January 19, 2001, that a final audit was conducted.
Record site for that?
I'm sorry. It is AA38, and I'm referencing the second page of the letter. At the second from the bottom line, it does identify final audit with a date applied of January 19, 2001. additional confirmation that, in fact, an audit was performed. The only way this invoice could have been created was by a determination as to what was owed, which then ultimately gives rise to a claim that Econ had against Employco, which starts the statute of limitations running.
But again, you had an obligation to provide payroll data, and council has just indicated they estimated what the payment would be, and you didn't provide the payroll data for another year.
Well, and I think, with all due respect to Mr. Dabowski, the period for the policy was November 3rd of 1999 through November 3rd of the year 2000. And it was on January 19th of 2001 that this final audit was provided. So any assertion that somehow there was a delay or that we weren't providing requested information, first of all, there's nothing in the record to identify that. And second, that was a very short time period, only of a couple months. And so, as Mr. Dubowski has identified, I mean, they had 3 years pursuant to the policy with which to conduct an audit. And in identifying, creating, and sending that particular invoice, which does identify that it is a final audit, that is when their claim became ripe. That is when they understood that they had a claim and the statute of limitations began to run. Obviously, we don't have any information. There's none in the record as to why Econ decided to wait 7 years to file this action, and we won't know that.
But when did your client's breach occur, as alleged, under the contract?
I don't think our clients, frankly, breached, because at the point in time at which the invoice was sent, well, I take that back. At the point in time that the invoice was sent, arguably under the policy, and again, we don't have it in front of us, is when we had an obligation to pay. So the breach would have taken place on January 19th of 2001 when we didn't pay the invoice as provided.
So you're saying that that establishes the contract and its breach for purposes of starting the statute of limitations? That's your argument on
Absolutely,
that?
Absolutely, yeah.
But if there was no performance due date on the invoice, is it due upon receipt? How do we know when the due date is?
Well, and I think that the case law from other jurisdictions is important here. And that case law essentially establishes that for purposes of workers' compensation claims, and noting that premiums are paid after the effective policy period, the point in time by which the statute begins to run is after an audit is conducted and the insured is invoiced. I mean, that's the law as we've
But as part and parcel of that, doesn't it make sense that the final audit can't be conducted until they have the payroll records in order to determine amount due?
Well, and my response, I guess, would be, well, they did. They did provide an invoice, and
But it was based upon an estimate as opposed to an evaluation and audit of the payroll records.
Sure. I understand that. And I think, ultimately, if they hadn't sent the invoice and demanded payment based upon whether it's an estimate or an actual audit with hard numbers or not, I don't think it makes any difference for purposes of the statute of limitation commencing, the time period commencing in this particular case. I think that the NVF case, which is a Delaware case, is on point in this regard, similar facts, and basically in that particular case, the insured was requesting, I believe, a rate adjustment. And as part of that process, there was an administrative proceeding, an appeal, and the insurance company in that particular case said, we can't provide actual hard numbers until that administrative proceeding is concluded. And the court essentially said, no, that's not true. You provided an audit, and at that point in time, your claim became ripe, and you have an obligation to file that action within the applicable statute of limitations. So I think the NVF case is obviously on point and persuasive authority. And I think going back, just with regard to the broader statute of limitations issues and when it commences, the Gonzalez case is instructive. The Gonzalez case identifies that you don't have to know with mathematical certainty what the value of your damages are or your claim. But what you have to understand is that you have been damaged and that you do have a claim and it is right. And in this particular case, I think it's clear that as of the January 19, 2001 invoice, Econ was aware that they had a claim, and yet they failed to file it within the applicable six-year statute of limitations period. And I think, Your Honor, you hit on the Havis case with regard to NRS 11200. I think, ultimately, that particular statute really doesn't have application to this particular set of facts. NRS 11.200 applies very well to installment contracts or contracts where there will be the sale and purchase of goods over a period of time, or even in the context of a contract where a breach occurs but the parties continue to perform under the agreement. Here, I think the facts are such that based upon Gonzalez and based upon their understanding that they had a claim as of January 19th of 2001, that statute really doesn't have any application to this particular case. And, Your Honor, you hit on the Havis case, which identified this notion of a gratuitous credit. I mean, taking Econ's position sort of to the extreme, Econ would be obligated merely to send an invoice once a year, reducing the amount it claims it's owed by $100, $200, and in effect extend out the statute of limitations indefinitely. And certainly that's not the policy behind the statutory scheme for statute of limitations. We've cited to you as well the McFerrin case, which supports the notion that extending out the statute of limitations and allowing subsequent audits time and time again violates essentially the policy behind the statute of limitations. And the whole purpose behind it is to provide some sort of cutoff date by which the parties, by which stale claims just go away. And I think that's obviously a very important point. And I don't think I have anything further unless you all have some questions.
Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Looking to the definition of audit, Blacks defines as a systematic inspection of accounting records involving analysis, tests, and confirmations. There's no, although they danced around, respectfully to Mr. Semenda, they danced around the question a little bit. There could have been no audit, and there certainly was no audit prior to January 2001, because they didn't help, they didn't cooperate, they didn't give any accounting records in order to audit. And they dance around the question and say, well, there must have been an audit because the invoice said there was an audit. They know there was no audit. The only audit was done after the payroll records were first furnished, and that was November 2001, and the audit was December 2001. And if you take their position, there was still a credit given. And that credit was given as a result of that audit. And to argue, to say that, well, NRS 11.200 applies better in installment contracts, well, that's not necessarily the case, but it applies. Because 11.200 is the law that governs statute of limitations on 11.190, written contracts, and there was a credit given. That credit was given not gratuitously. It was given when the audit was conducted, and the audit was an actual audit after everything was furnished to my client. With regard to NDA,
do you think the policy would have yielded greater clarity on when the breach allegedly occurred?
It could, yes, because the policy does state that an audit is necessary in order to calculate the premiums, and that audit could be conducted within 3 years.
Is you rely on the statute to supply that piece of information to this court, but if this case were to be remanded, the policy would then be put in, presumably, so the court could assess breach and
yes.
Timing of performance?
Yes. And finally, just to touch upon the Gonzalez case, I believe this court overturned in 1998. So the Gonzalez case on the discovery rule is no longer law.
Go ahead and finish your thought.
Thank you. The Gonzalez case, again, overturned with regard to the discovery rule, which is what they're trying to argue. So although they're only offering it by way of analogy because it's not governing law, in terms of the principle, because its governing law is 11.200, the case itself, I believe, was overturned in 1998 in a case called Copica. So it doesn't support their case either in principle or in binding authority. And just finally on the NVF case, the insurance company filed their action beyond the statute of limitations, which was 3 years after the audit. And if you look at that Delaware, the Delaware statutory statute of limitations, 3 years, the insurance company went beyond the 3 years, filed the case, and argued tolling. So it has no bearing on this case, not just because obviously it's another jurisdiction, but also because it has not this issue. In that case, they argued tolling because there was some kind of administrative action pending with regard to rates that did not affect the debt, according to the court, and therefore there was no tolling. But the principle is what is consistent with our case, which is the statute of limitations accrues from the date of the audit. And in this case, the audit was December 2001. We filed this case within 6 years of that date on October 2007.
All right. Counsel, thank both of you. We appreciate your time and your briefs and the argument in this case, and the matter will stand submitted. And we will stand in recess until 1:30.